You are listening to John Diard's Life Spa, your premier source for health news and Ayurveda, where modern science meets ancient wisdom.
Hi, everybody. I'm Dr. John Diard, and welcome to the Life Spa podcast, where we prove the ancient medical wisdom of Ayurveda with modern science. And today, we're going to take a deep dive into some aspects of Ayurveda. We're going to talk about something called Shivambu, which is urine therapy. We're going to dive deeply into nitric oxide. So there's going to be a lot of really interesting information, somewhat controversial, but we're going to take a deep dive with an expert, Kate Stillman. She's here with us. She's the founder of yogahealer.com. She teaches yoga. She teaches yoga instructors. She's a certified Ayurvedic practitioner. She provides health coaching certification. Most recently, she created something called the Wellness Pro Academy, where she helps wellness businesses get off the ground. And we all know how hard it is for wellness businesses to get started. She's really good at that. She's the author of 4 books. My favorites are Primal Habits and Body Thrives. And welcome, Kate. So great to have you and see you again. She's a long-term friend of mine. I've known her forever. I know she studied Ayurveda in the 90s and I started in the late 80s. So she's one of the originals and been around forever, even though she looks like she's 20. She's brilliant and has tons of experience. So Kate, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, John, I'm so excited to dive in.
Yeah, so I want to start with a little bit of a discussion about, let's just dive right into urine therapy. You know, it's a super controversial issue, but it is a part of Ayurveda and other cultures used it as well. And I know you've done a lot of research on this, so I just want to hear you just tell us all about it and why we should do it or consider it and its history and everything about it.
Yeah, so one of the things I love about the Vedic teachings is they're time-tested, right? They're these written and oracle teachings that have survived time, and where my awareness naturally goes is into like big systems thinking. So I've always had like a much bigger perspective. So I look at not just what is arising in Ayurveda, but what also are some of these ancient truths that are arising in other cultures. And one of those funny things that shows up everywhere is urine therapy. And so when I ask the question, instead of looking at like the way I do research and the way I look at things is not through double blind studies, it's more of just a deep dive into literature, into scientific literature. And so I just looked at like where is urine therapy showed up over time and why might it work? And so instead of starting with the assumption of it doesn't work, I started with the assumption that things that show up in multiple cultures and survive the test of time might work for some reason. I have also had a podcast for, I don't know, maybe close to 15 years now. And so I've had the opportunity to interview a lot of different types of people, including medical doctors. One doctor I interviewed at UCLA, I asked him if he'd ever seen it in studies. And he said, yeah, actually we measured the electrolytes of a postpartum lab rat because we noticed that it was drinking the baby. So it just had a bunch of babies and it was drinking. It was upcycling is one of the things that we call it, is how do you upcycle? And this is a very different type of a term for most people to look at it that in a biological way is how do we upcycle? And so the mama rat was upcycling the baby's urine. And so the doc who is the head of medicine at UCLA, he was like, well, I might as well measure and see why she might be doing this. And sure enough, the electrolytes skyrocketed in the mother. So there is scientific studies, there is anecdotal evidence. One of the things that I'm most interested in is citizen data, is like what have citizens been doing outside of profit-driven corporations over time. And urine therapy actually shows up in Chinese medicine, it shows up in Ayurvedic medicine, it shows up in the Pali Canon from the Buddha, it shows up in Irish folklore, it shows up in Mexican folklore. It's something that we see all over. So then the question that I asked is like, why might it work?
It's amazing. I love how you got here and I love where we're going with this. I think it's super exciting. I was just thinking as you're talking, I was like, this is such a cool concept, you know, because, you know, I don't think that everything that's ancient wisdom is necessarily, you know, what we should all be doing today. However, Look at something that's been around for 1,000 years and still practiced today. And we have science to prove it. You know, sort of my stick as well is take the ancient wisdom. If I can find science to back it up, I'm going to go, wait a minute, we should at least look at this. And that's what we're doing today. We're going to at least look at this. And as you look deeper into it, you might actually be inclined to experiment it. When I went to India back in the late 80s, I know that I had got a rash all over my body. And didn't know why. I never get rashes before, but I did. So one of the doctors, Ayurvedic doctors, will just put your urine on it. And that was the first time I ever heard of that. I was like, right, you know. But he convinced me to give it a go, and I did. And the rash went away very, very quickly. And it turned out that the rash was from, I got ringworm, because in India, when they do your laundry, they do it the old-fashioned way. They dry it on a hanger, but oftentimes they fold it when it's still wet. And so I was putting clothes on that were still a little damp and got this kind of ringworm kind of thing a lot all over. It was absolutely the urine, just put it on, that had this pretty amazing effect, which made me, you know, a believer to a certain extent. And I've tried it on and off many times. I can't say that I noticed any difference, but, you know, I don't really have a lot of problems to really measure. And so I'm super excited and all in for you to take this deeper. So tell us more.
Yeah, there's so many different ways to go in this conversation. But the first thing that I like to address is disgust. So that was one of the things that I looked at, is like disgust is, there's a biological function to disgust, and then there's a cultural function to disgust. So if we look at the biological function of disgust with urine therapy, we find it actually doesn't really exist. It's more of a cultural function. So what that means is that if you want to have power over someone, you can entrain culturally what is disgusting. And in that, you can create an in-group and an out-group. We actually saw this during COVID with masking. There's a lot of shaming that went on with people who didn't mask, and they were then labeled as, you know, disgusting, inconsiderate, et cetera. So this is something that it exists across time. So how cultures define disgust, sometimes there is a biological basis for that. And then sometimes there's not. So that's something that it's important to consider. It's like, how do we entrain disgust? Because children are not naturally disgusted by their urine. They're actually quite fascinated by it. Other mammals are doing urine therapy. And in fact, the doctor from UCLA, from his perspective, it was like, why do mammals do it? So if we look at that perspective, it's like, why do mammals do urine therapy? Humans are primates, primates are mammals. So if we look at it from that perspective, we also get a potentially a different angle in or lens in that might supersede our natural and culturally entrained disgust. So in cultures where there's not that culturally entrained disgust, we don't have that aversion. So I just want to highlight that, because if anyone right now is listening, like, you can just do a check, like on a scale of 1 to 10, how disgusted are you by the idea of upcycling urine or urine as medicine? Because some of the conversations that we're going to go into next is like, how might you use it, right? So how might you use it, and what benefit might you get from using it? And you might notice a lot of aversion coming up in the process. And I just invite everyone just to note, like, some of you, it's going to be a 10 out of 10. Like, this is like, you're intrigued because this is like crazy talk and what crazy humans are doing. And some of you might be more scientifically minded and see more of a, like, actually, I'm not that disgusted. Urine's a substance. It's ultra plasma filtrate. Like, it's coming out of the blood plasma. It's not coming out of necessarily a waste channel. And how might we see that which has been basically a structured water in the body? So those of you who study structured water, you can see this is your own structured water. So if we go a little bit more into the mystical with it, everyone's urine is different. It's unique fingerprint or foot, or like snowflake of who you are. So no two urines are the same. It has over 4,000 metabolites as measured by some scientific institute in Seattle that just focuses on like figuring out what's in urine. So basically the way we measure things, as we get more sophisticated measuring technology, we notice there's more and more and more stuff that's actually in the human body that is showing up in our blood, that's then showing up in our urine.
One thing before, it's so cool what you're talking about. And I love the fact that it's disgusting and people are kind of turned off by it, maybe more some more than others. But what you mentioned earlier was in a really important point, is that, you know, there's this kind of monetizing medicine that has really taken over in our culture, and things that are free, like your own urine, clearly easy to make that disgusting, easy to make that something that who in the world would do it unless you were like, you know, a peasant or someone who, you know, lower level kind of human being would only do that. We're not animals. Why would we drink our urine? And much of that disgust might have been, you know, created by an institution that was trying to, you know, create, maybe even take advantage of you in a certain way. We're taking, you know, the responsibility for our own health away. And
can I pause on that? Because I want to talk about that in terms of the Vedic sciences.
Yeah.
Because I have some, I mean, you imagine, and I just want to say, you guys, like those who don't know me, like I didn't really sign up for this, you know, like that's what, that was my feeling, is like, really, I got to be the one in Ayurvedic medicine who does the deep dive on urine therapy and legitimizes it. Like that created an enormous amount of chaos in my business and in my community, because I was willing to commit to truth and wisdom over dollar signs. And anyone who makes that decision, it's like, there are repercussions to it and it is real. So one of the things that I found, John, and this to me is, I would just love for, I'd love to elevate this conversation within the Ayurvedic community, the Ayurvedic professional community, both in India and globally, is basically the conclusion that I reached was that every reference to oil in the in Charak Samhita and otherwise is aged urine. It's evolved urine. So urine changes. This is something that's not very well understood. I have deep reverence and thanks to the late Swami Rama, who spent a lot of time in both in creating hospitals and actually documenting the changes that yogis could make on their autonomic nervous system. This was completely underground. Anyone who's familiar with the Himalayan Institute, you're not going to see any of this on the website, et cetera. This just comes from actually meeting one of his proteges and spending a bit of time with her and learning. She learned directly from him. I learned directly from her. So that said, it's in the culture. The reason it went underground, why did it go to the Vedic system? And I don't know if it was the same thing in the caste system, as far as like the priestly class wanted to hold the wisdom, therefore making medicine less of the people's medicine. I don't know how far back that goes. Would love to learn more. That said, why did Swami Rama and other, you know, people who have been doing the evolved urine therapies, and we'll get into oxidation reduction potential in the body and how that intersects microbiome and nitric oxide and, you know, the whole, like, what are the mechanics of free electrons that can like zap bacteria and viruses in the body? And like, where does this really go? To me, it's very, very, very fascinating. What we do know is that in the yogic system and in the Buddhist system, because it does show up in the Pali Canon, that urine does change. So evolved urine is at least 9 months old. It turns into a substance. Actually, do I have any on my desk? No. It turns into a substance that looks a lot more like, very similar to alcohol, like how you have new, like if you like take tequila or whiskey, like the lighter versions are newer and the aged versions are darker. So blancos and añejos, and I spent a lot of time in Mexico, but blancos and añejos, like young is white and old is like a very dark whiskey, very, very dark brown or Coca-Cola colored. So it moves through this nitrogen cycle. And one of the things that fascinated me is like, we know about nitric oxide, the three gas system as of like the mid 90s, those of you who were in biology class before the mid 90s, you learned about a two gas system in the body. You learned about oxygen and carbon dioxide. Well, around the mid 90s, the nitric oxide was discovered as a molecule, and the three gas system of nitric oxide is that which enables our red blood cells to absorb oxygen. That third gas was understood to be now a three gas system as part of like our breathing cycle and oxygenation cycle. And, you know, you and I talked yesterday on my show a little bit about carbon dioxide in the body. Well, nitric oxide and this third gas has everything to do with the nitrogen cycle. And what is happening with oxidation reduction potential in new urine versus aged urine? new urine has about a negative 25 oxidation reduction potential, meaning it's reducing the oxidation in the cells in your body. Aged urine on ORP meters goes up to negative 200 ORP. So it seems to be that as urine gets older, its ability to create an abiotic environment around our cells that are, and I'm going to introduce a new word, an enthalpy, which I love this word. This word enthalpy and upcycling to me is very sophisticated. Enthalpy is the preservation of the genetic code and the furthering of the potential from the past. Entropy is the degradation of the genetic code, right? So this enthalpy seems to happen through reducing oxidation in the body.
Let me ask you a question. I love where you're going with this. We know that you can produce more nitric oxide in your body, which of course research on won the Nobel Prize as the panacea. It's produced everywhere in your body, sort of supports vasodilation, carries, helps the body deliver oxygen. And it turned out that it actually functions a lot like a hormone when you put like beets, which are high in nitrates and nitrites. Plant-based versions of them are actually nitric oxide stimulators. And that triggers a production of nitric oxide, not just in your mouth locally, but globally throughout your whole body. And research shows that by the time you're 40 years old, you've lost about 40 to 50% of your nitric oxide production. So we know that this is directly linked to the accelerated aging. And we know that there are ways to increase your nitric oxide production. You can take beets and arugula and spinach and watermelon and different types of arginine and citrulline agents to make that happen. But I'm kind of wondering about the urine. Is there nitrites and nitrites in there? Is that what's causing this nitric oxide, you know, boost from that? To give me exactly what is in the urine that makes that nitric oxide boost.
Yeah, right. Like this is so to some degree, John, I'm like, you really run into a dead end with this stuff.
Okay.
Right. Because like who's pouring money into urine studies? The two big things you've got in urea is in urea and uric acid. And the way that I see these two is polarity, yin yang, right? So you've got, or male, female, where you've got top and bottom, right? So uric acid is the strongest antioxidant in the body. Urea works like oil in our Ayurveda. It's softening. And this is why urea, like the best skin creams have urea. Urea is one of the best skin barriers. It's the urea studies are fascinating. They mostly use synthetic urea. So you don't really have really good humans using human urea studies. Hopefully in the future, we might, if shows like this get a little bit of exposure. So what we do know about urea is that it's like antibacterial, antiviral, anticarcinogenic. So somehow when we put urea on the skin, even in the synthetic form, it can kill dysbiosis and it can nourish eubiosis. So now we go really quickly into microbiome when we start to talk about the nitrogen cycle and nitric oxide and what happens when we can talk about in Uninflamed, which is my 90,000 word book that talks about all the things. We just took Primal Habits out of it because a lot of people are like, I don't care about the science. Like, just tell me what to do. So that's Primal Habits. Uninflamed is like, here's everything I can figure out in 90,000 words or less. When people swish it, right? And this, again, it's going to get gross. We're going to talk about swishing urine and we're going to talk about snorting urine. And this has everything to do with this nitric oxide production in the orolome or the mouth microbiome and the sinus microbiome.
Hey, wait, so, before you do that, before you go there,
yeah,
can you give us a mechanism of how the urea activates the nitrogen cycle?
Yeah, I mean, this is where it gets really interesting, right? Like if we look at what is urea, like what is in urea and what is in uric acid, like what is the primary molecule is nitrogen.
Okay.
Right. So we're putting nitrogen and it goes through various forms, right? It turns into an ammonia. So when we look at like the cycle, when you first pee, right? It's mostly that water. Then it off gases and it goes high in ammonia, right? And anyone who's ever cleaned house with their grandma, she probably used ammonia to clean the house before we had aisles full of like cleansing products that had all sorts of stuff in them. is ammonia. And then as it ages, it changes in that ORP, right? That ability to antioxidize, like that increases, and it becomes very, what's the word in Sanskrit? That like word of like slippery and sticky, like that sukshma and slesha, like it gets, right. Changes into those qualities. Now, how much nitrogen is in fresh urine versus aged urine? My guess is you're going to see a lot more in aged urine. If you look at how do we fertilize crops, right? How do we fertilize plants? We use nitrogen cycle. So there's a lot of nitrogen in the urine itself mixed with water. So it's mixed with hydrogen and oxygen. So what effect is that having in terms of the body's ability to produce nitric oxide? It seems to increase it, right? And how might we measure that? We might measure that in the orolome in dysbiosis. We might measure it in the ostia and how occluded the ostia are in the nose. People that snort urine, snorting, because urine is going through all of these different phases from like super more, I look at it like hydration. And then I look at it as nutrition and then as medicine. So if we're talking about medicine, we're talking about evolved or aged, which means it's over 9 months, which means it's going to look more like Coca-Cola, it's going to be more slippery and it's going to have more nitric oxide to water. If we look at fresh and hydration, it's going to be high in electrolytes. It's going to be prebiotic, probiotic. It's going to be high in structured water content and have much less nitrogen in it, like per ounce, if you will. Nutrition, this is where this last piece, and what we notice is that people who, again, we have to look at citizen data because there are not studies on this. So with citizen data, people who are trying to do extended fasting, urine has, your body produces about 100 calories in urine a day. So it's not nothing. It's not the same as water. There's nutrition in it. And what we find is that people who do extended fast or want to do like an easier 3-day water fast or 72-hour water fast or an easier 5-day fast mimicking diet in order to get the benefits of autophagy and apoptosis or cellular regeneration is that it's much easier for those people to do it with urine, with what's called looping. And this is where they ingest all of the urine that they pee out. They drink all of that back in. They get that 100 calories back in. And the actual taste of the urine changes to be like something like a very light fruit juice or coconut water within 24 hours. And so the taste dramatically changes depending on what we're taking in, and that hydration factor happens. Now, how much more nitric oxide is being produced in the body of someone who's looping, doing a fast mimicking diet? We have no idea. There's no data that I could find. And I looked for like 2 years. So if anyone has it, please send it to me, because I'd love to keep updating on Inflamed with whatever we can find. So do I know exactly how urine is increasing nitric oxide production in the orolome or the sinus microbiome or the gut microbiome or the lungs or the blood microbiome? I don't. It has a lot to do with the NOS cycle and the ROS cycle, like reactive oxygen species and nitrogen oxygen species. And about this point, it far exceeds my understanding of biochemistry.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, the fact that, you know, there's nitrogen in there and it can activate, you know, the nitrogen cycle by delivering nitrites or just nitrogen and activate that cycle, that makes sense. And the research does show if you can produce it in one place, you can produce it in every place, which that's kind of the unique thing about nitric oxide, you know, kind of re-stimulation. You know, also urine is sterile. If you're healthy, it's a sterile agent.
Let's define that.
Okay.
Let's define sterile.
Okay, go ahead. You're the expert. But generally speaking, you shouldn't have bacteria in your urine. True?
No. I think it was like 2013, somewhere between 2013 and 2018. Science depends on measurement, right? So as measurement equipment becomes more sophisticated, meaning we can measure lighter and lighter molecules and particles, the data then changes. So we do find that there is a healthy microbiome in urine. There's also a dysbiotic microbiome in people's urine who are dysbiotic. So if you have a yeast infection, if you have candida, if you have urinary tract infection, you're going to see those bacteria also show up in the urine. Now, where sterile actually makes sense is when we think of sterility we often, I think of like some, a clean environment, like the word in Sanskrit of saucha, something that's clean. Now, again, there's an ammonia cycle in urine. So urine is used as a cleaning agent. So those, so people that I, so I'm, you know, very involved in the citizen data with urine therapy. And one of the things that naturally happens is you actually start to clean with urine. And it sounds so bizarre and so gross until you understand ammonia and the natural ammonia cycle and having an environment that's not actually sterile, but actually having an environment around you that's probiotic. That's actually like a living microbiome. And this is what we know from the microbiome studies is like the more we're involved in a living microbiome, we have our hands in the soil, we let our dogs lick us on the face, you know, we let our kids pick their nose. You know, these things are actually upcycling. If we're living, you know, a little bit closer to the earth and we're doing a little bit of gardening, we're actually mixing the compost of the cow dung, which is the largest repertoire of like living microbiome, into the soil. The soil is the largest living microbiome outside of the cow dung that has dead and alive species and a lot more archaea or ancient species. And so the more we're integrated into our ecosystem, the healthier we are. And this will come out in all of the the malas in Ayurveda, or the body waste products all have their own microbiomes.
True, I get that. So that's, so it's not quite sterile, but it's very clean. And obviously it would make sense that if you're a healthy person with healthy urine, that would be, I don't know.
And it's antiviral and antibacterial. And I think that's maybe that part of sterile that we're kind of associating with.
Right. So wouldn't, so, well, there's two things. There's, I have two questions. One, let's just say that it's not the microbiome piece, but it's actually the fact that the urine is actually deep, you know, getting rid of certain toxins at a microscopic level. So almost like a homeopathic law of similars level. Yeah. Does urine, if you drink it, create kind of a subtle homeopathic recognition of toxins that your body can't, is over, is not able, kidneys aren't able to reuse it, so it dumps it out as a toxin. That toxin is obviously something your body didn't want to reabsorb, so it got rid of it. And if you can get the body to recognize that toxin at some subtle kind of looping level, then the body would go, oh, on a homeopathic level, the body can recognize that problem as a problem, where before it was just fully engaged in the detoxification of it, but the looping restores a level of awareness so the body can deal with that problem upstream earlier on before it becomes a major problem. So that's one question. Is there a homeopathic effect, you know, that subtle titrated effect, healing effect of a toxin? And number two, if you're a healthy person, I could see the benefit of that. But if you have, if you're unhealthy and you have, you know, bacteria in your urine and things like that, like, where's the line? Does that unhealthy urine taken in have even a more beneficial therapeutic effect to actually heal that person, or is it something they should stay away from?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, that the only place that I have really seen where dose should be considered is with pharmaceutical use, right? Good. Because now all of a sudden, like because what we notice in urine therapy is people need less, they need less supplements, they need less medication. And so because of the liver function and, you know, because we're basically like taking more in at that point, like then we would want to alter dose. And the problem is like, yeah, you're going to talk to this, your doctor about this. So like, really? Good luck. You know, so that's, that part's hard, but for everyone else, yeah, let's start with the homeopathic. So in all the images, I have cartoons. So one of the ways that we use humor is comic. And so I have comic strip cartoons in Uninflamed. It was a labor of love for sure, but I have like something like 90 images, most of which are on urine therapy because it's easier to see in cartoon form, certain things like this. And there is one on the homeopathic. So homeopathically, what you want to do is you want to catch your urine in the morning. So your first urine is the most potent. This goes back, the Dhamma Sutra is the one in Ayurveda that has these texts. I can't find a source, an origin source for that. As far as I know, it's not that old, like 500 years old. My guess is there's much older sources, but again, a lot of this stuff went underground. So anyone has a source on that, let me know on that. I'd love to put that back into the book. Okay, so that said, like first catch midstream is what the Dhamma Sutra says, and that will then be taken under the tongue. So put it in like a 1 ounce water bottle, take a few drops under the tongue. And that's how you would get that homeopathic upcycling or that enthalpic response. Instead of entropy, now the body has enthalpy, which means you're upcycling the genetic code and opening to the possibilities. Aged urine, same way. So aged, it's going to take you 9 months if you start today before you have aged urine. Aged urine that's a few years old is even better than 9 month old urine, but that would be the what you would then use as a homeopathic dose. The other part of that is the antibodies, like how much does it actually help your body? So say you do have an infection, whether it's viral or antibiotic, like will your body recognize what it's fighting and be able to produce more antibodies? And in the citizen data, like people do respond, like they do say that they get healthier faster. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, let's get into the details here. If you age the urine, is it covered in a refrigerator or open? You know, how does that work?
Yeah, I have a good little cartoon picture of that too, of like the Ayurvedic, of the Shivambu. So Shivambu is the word, and just because you do Ayurveda, I'll bring in the Sanskrit. So Shiva means God, Ambu means water. And that is the term for urine therapy in Sanskrit, which I do believe is important because we do see that God water reference actually cross-culturally. So we do see that show up in different places in the globe in cultures that were completely unrelated, which I do find that part fascinating as well. So you pee in a glass jar. I like glass in general, as the medium. I don't, you know, any like plastics. I don't like metal. Also in Ayurveda, those of you study Ayurveda, like know that metal actually has an effect. And we're not actually looking for an effect. We're just looking for something that could essentially like dry into a salt, and urine does dry into a salt. We know also historically that salt was a currency once upon a time. And my guess is salt was a currency once we actually had separated humans from their natural ability to create their own salts. And salt is the crystallized form. Hey, friend, that you can self carry around and have your own medicine for the rest of your life. Go ahead.
Wait, are you saying that urine salt was a currency?
No. When salt became a currency, when we know that primates had lost the natural function of drying their urine into a salt.
Oh,
so humans, if you think back, like we didn't have water bottles, right? Water wasn't always available, right? Salt wasn't always available, but we were able to upcycle our own water and dehydrate our own salt. And that salt is the crystallized form of svastha. So in Ayurveda, we have a one word definition of health. I would say that is svastha, or seated in the self. Sva means self, stha is the seat. So our ability to be upcycled in our own unique snowflake, for us to be in our fingerprint of our blood plasma, or like if your essence is crystallized into matter, and we were to say, what is exactly that matter? It would be, according to the yogis, that would be crystallized dried urine. And that would then be a medicine salt that you could carry with you that would keep you hydrated. It would also have, you know, basically the blueprint of your, to say genetic code might be generous, but of your essence, of your water essence, your Shivambu, your God water.
Okay, so we put this water in a glass, we keep it open, and it lies there for 9 months, and it gets, when does it become a salt, and what does it look like after 9 months, and how long does it take for that to actually become a full-on salt, and is it open the whole time?
It's so crazy. So like, depending on where you live, right, there's flies and there's bugs, so some of you might need like, you know, just like a screen over it with a rubber band. You're in like, It likes the elements. It likes hot and cold. It likes to freeze and to thaw. It likes to breathe. So if it's just bottled, it doesn't have that oxidation function, which messes with its ammonia and maturation cycle. So even if you do keep, like some people have a special like mini fridge, which you can get at literally any garage sale that I've gone to seems to have an extra mini fridge. Like you can just have a mini fridge and keep your urine in its aging process in a mini fridge if you're going to get serious about it. And then every now and then just open it, let it breathe. I keep mine on a shelf in the garage. So we have garage lockers in our garage. Our garage looks more like a sporting facility than anything else. And in my locker, I have a shelf of aging urine in its various forms. With just a little cloth and a rubber band over it. So I use cloth instead of netting. And so it's always breathing. And then it will dehydrate. So where I live, it's a fairly dry climate. So depending how much urine you're trying to dry out, obviously with desiccation, anyone who has a dehydrator, you know, like you can dry things out really fast. if you create an environment with some heat and some wind. So that is variable in terms of like how long does it take to become salt.
So, I mean, after 9 months, I'd imagine it, everything would have evaporated and you're just left with,
So say this is like, say this jar, say this is full, right now it's full of urine, it's not catching.
That's a lot of urine, okay.
Okay, so say this is full of urine, only about, and I'm showing about a, it's probably like a liter and a quarter jar, about a quarter of it will evaporate.
Oh.
So not that much. And you could keep it like, this is like partially capped with like a little bit of air coming in, like that's plenty. And it will go through a very strong off-gassing cycle. And I want to speak to you guys about this too, John, because this to me is really important in terms of the sinus microbiome and the ability for our blood to absorb more oxygen has everything to do with what's going on in the sinuses. And we should really talk about the taste receptors that are in the sinuses and our sense of smell and how that goes in through the olfactory bulbs into the brain, into the cerebrospinal fluid, and why Yogi snorted urine.
Let's dive into that. But before we go there, does it ever become an actual granular salt?
Yes.
And how does that happen?
Yeah, you want, like this- I could go show you some. Before it's a salt, it's not a white salt, it's a brown salt. So it turns brown.
Like it would take a year, 2 years, three
no,
years?
No, I mean, if you have a dehydrator, like you could stick your urine in a dehydrator in it. But the thing is, the older it is, the more the water is evaporated, the higher the, and again, like we need to measure what's in this stuff. I don't know. You're like what the users say is they're like growth hormones, stem cells, this thing's alive, it's evolving.
Yeah, right.
There's like all the folklore around like the user community about what's in it. I don't know. It turns brown, right? And then it dries into a brown salt. And then we have people like Swami Rama, right? That have been like, these are people that can stop their heartbeat, that can change their body temperature, that can, you know, they're like the modern day Wim Hofs. That's what Swami Rama is. And they're saying like, this is how we use it. And that I find fascinating.
Right. But he was more of a breathing guy, that his urine drinking habit wasn't really, you know, populated as how he became, you know, so.
And the reason, again, will bring us right back into cultural adoption and disgust. So if we look at his modus operandi, he's like, how do I help yoga and Ayurveda spread in the United States? I do not lead with urine therapy. In fact, that goes and stays underground, as did a lot of the tantric teachings were underground, right? So a lot of this, actually in my cartoon book on pee, I call it the Underground Pee Drinking Society, because it's like, When a sacred wisdom, it gets encoded, a lot of the Vedic teachings, a lot of the teachings from Kashmir Shaivism, et cetera, from like about 1,000 years past the classical yogic texts, we have the Kashmir Shaivic texts, and those are encoded. So there's a very deep history in Vedic culture in the priestly caste of encoding the wisdom for preservation. So that as things became popular, unpopular in politics, right? Politics and priestly class, those are different. Politics is much more in the mercantile class. So as these two things become separated, we have encoded wisdom. Is encoded wisdom, you know, often will be at a level of not socially, culturally accepted, right? So we don't lead with it. How we know Swami Rama was using urine, he was aging it, he was doing enemas, he was snorting, he was doing it for self-massage. So again, anywhere you're going to see oil used in the text, you just do a find replace with oil and you put in evolved urine, because it
that's becomes, a lot. That's a lot of places. If we look at the Vedas,
that's a lot of places, because there's a lot of microbiomes and all the microbiomes rely on nitrogen. And uric acid and urea are highest in nitrogen for what the body produces.
Okay, so tell us what you've experienced, what conditions you've given it for, what the dose is. Is it always just under the tongue like a homeopathic dose, or do you actually drink a certain amount?
Yeah.
And what conditions have you used it for, and what have you seen?
Yeah, so this is another sort of like crazy story. So I'm very high in openness in Western psychology, and the communities I led, I'm very receptive to member-led communities. So while I'm the organizer of Club Thrive, and I was the organizer of Body Thrive, the community before Club Thrive, you know, when members wanted to learn something or wanted to share what they knew, I, you know, was just like, great, let's try it. Let's test it. Always be experimenting is our motto. We're very strong believers in svadhyaya, the concept of sva, self, dhyā, to know or to study. So as opposed to just like taking advice from experts, my community is very much a yoga community of self-study and self-experimentation. So one of my members in yoga health coaching who was coming to me for business, basically like, how do I run a better business? She said, what do you know about Shivambu? And I said, what? And she said, what do you know about urine therapy? And I was like, well, I interviewed Dr. Bruce Fife 20 years ago. He told me about it. I studied urine diagnostics in Ayurvedic medicine school and in India. Like, but as a practice, like I tried it. I could never really adopt it. And what I basically found is like, it's very hard to adopt positive stressor habits that are challenged by cultural reasons if no one around you is doing it. So what we decided as a community is like, whoever wants to run on the next experiment, let's see what happens. We had about 100 people adopt it immediately. Most of them were yoga teachers from around the world. And so this was like a very like high tolerance group to things that were a little bit out of the box. And most of them had some background in tantric yoga as well as classical yoga. And all of that really helped. So what did we start to see? Well, one of the first things that we learned as a community is that urine therapy is entirely intuitive. So if someone is telling you how to do it, that's already wrong. Like it's already misguided to the essence of Shivambu. Shivambu is your connection with yourself as divinity. You don't need a priest. You don't need a doctor. You don't need a scientific study. Like you don't need anything in between you and the divine. So that said, and it being intuitive, some people have an easier time topically. So one of the first experiments that we were taught to run, just shout out to Megan and our community, is that when you pee, so for a week, just pee and catch a few drops on your right hand and rub it on the top of your left hand. And just do that for a week. And don't wash your hands after, which I know for many people, this is going to go to disgust really quickly. And you might need to use your foot and use your left foot instead of your hand. And then so you can wash your hands and feel like you're antiseptic again. Then you would notice the difference in your skin after a week. And there are enough urea studies. And we know that urea is used in expensive skin creams and whatnot, that you'll notice like a softening. And you'll also notice often more connection, that you just feel more, your left foot just feels more connected to your body than your right foot. Under the tongue, that homeopathic with fresh urine is also a way to go, where you're just starting to upcycle taste. So you're upcycling the taste. And the taste, if it's disgusting, it means what you're eating is disgusting. What you're producing is disgusting. So what starts to naturally happen is things that are making your urine disgusting become less appealing. So if you're eating a junk food diet, or if you're drinking a lot of alcohol, or you're eating a lot of processed food, is you naturally will have less inclination towards those. So again, kind of like a homeopathic upcycling effect of the intelligence of taste starts to happen if you do it under the tongue. So on the like, what are some of like the crazy wild stories? It's like, it just goes on and on. So one of, I've had a client for years who really struggled with rhinitis. And so like just a lot of inflammation in her sinuses. Often when this happens to people, it seems like the sinus microbiome becomes osteophyte or fibrotic, or the tissue just, the microbiome dies. It's like a coral reef and it dies in the sinuses, which means the lungs aren't able to produce as much nitric oxide because it's the sinus microbiome that produces the nitric oxide for the lungs to expand. And then the lungs produce nitric oxide to then for the blood to be able to carry more oxygen into the cells. And when this system gets shut down, the body is really just facing a hard time with just getting enough oxygen. So she struggled with allergies forever and ever and ever. Like she's actually one of my original yoga students when I owned a yoga studio here in Teton Valley, Idaho. And yeah, her allergies, you know, through us using traditional Ayurvedic practices and breathing techniques and nausea oils and neti pot and all the things, intermittent fasting, seasonal detox, they were about 70% better. And she was happy with that. Like if you're suffering all the time, 70% is pretty good. But it was actually snorting urine, and you start with fresh. And as it ages, you start to use it. It gets really spicy and the ammonia cycle gets really, really rajasic. So it goes from hydration, somewhat sattvic, to very rajasic within 24 hours. It stays rajasic for about 9 months, then it becomes sattvic. Right? It never goes to tamasic unless you have funguses in you and then you see the fungus separate from the aged urine. We can go there later. what we found is like complete resolution within about a year. So 100%. So anyone struggling with allergies, anyone who's struggling with mouth breathing, we want to open the ostia, which are between your nostrils and your sinuses. We want those to be full flow passages that can collect bacteria from and viruses from the outside environment and you be like a filter. And then we want the sinuses producing a ton of nitric oxide. And that does seem to happen with that. And then you could just apply that to any microbiome in the body. So I'm very curious, John, about Rasa Dhatu. And I know you talk a lot about how the lymphatic system in the body is like the plumbing system and is the filtration system. And you don't want your plumbing to get clogged. In my experience, when we upcycle our urine in the morning, so traditionally it's like you just drink your morning urine once a day, and that's it. It's just part of the dinacharya or the daily routine. Is what happens is it seems to be a cleanser for the rasa dhatu. It seems to cleanse. Often we just pee a lot of it back out, and it's much more watery when we pee it out, and the body's taking in minerals, it's taking in electrolytes from the pee. If we look at constipation, this is something that I had, like many children raised in the Dr. Spock era of parenting, had a lot of unattachment conditioning. It was my deepest trauma, and that created constipation in my body where the apana vayu couldn't drop, basically due to a very, very deep-seated fear response. Anyone studying the work of Gabor Mate knows a lot about attachment parenting. And when that doesn't happen, there are studies that in rat studies that show that within the first 24 hours of a baby being separated from the mother, it can create epigenetic changes that last for a lifetime. And a lot of my health issues did stem from being unattached from my parent immediately, from my mother immediately. And constipation was one of the first signs that showed up for me as a baby. It's something that I struggled with. Ayurveda helped a lot, like traditional Ayurveda. But since the day I started doing urine enemas, I've never been constipated, like not a single day have I not had complete elimination. And that's from both doing a urine enema in the morning. So I just pee, I just take the pee and I put it back in using a syringe. I use a 60-ounce syringe. And then I drink my morning urine and the body just releases whatever it wants to release.
How much do you drink?
Depending on the day. So again, like urine's intuitive. So people that are long-term, so we have to look at citizen data because there's no studies. So we have to look at like, how are people using it over time? Because it's intuitive and because there's so many ways to use it, there's a lot of people who are more into urine therapy only use evolved urine. They don't use fresh at all unless they're detoxing and then they'll loop. I find I go in phases. Right now I'm drinking all my morning urine. So I'll pee, I'll use the 60-ounce syringe, I'll do one 60-ounce syringe enema, I'll drink the rest, then I'll have a complete bowel movement. And that's just so, again, it's intuitive, it's personal. Some people just do swishing, snorting, skin massage, and they don't drink at all. Some people only drink. Some people do foot baths. The foot baths are amazing. Like it's like anyone, especially that's two in their head, starting to do foot baths, it's like all the urea, the skin turns amazing and soft. And because the largest pores are in the feet, they can absorb larger molecules into the blood. So a lot of people use just foot baths.
So you think that this is predominantly kind of an agent that's going to increase the natural production of nitric oxide over time because we do lose that with age?
Yeah.
You think that's the main active ingredient?
Yeah, I think we don't know the nitrogen cycle of the body and we don't understand oxidation reduction potential in terms of aged urine and what's happening with the nitric oxide cycle. I don't think we understand the different phases that urine goes in from sapphic to rhizosphic in terms of ammonia and how we might use that medicinally for specific conditions, especially, you know, we use a lot of rhizosphic actions in panchakarma. I would say panchakarma is a very rhizosphic process that has a sattvic outcome. So when we're looking to actually disturb the doshas out of the, whether it's out of the cells or out of the systems, we use rhizosphic actions. And that's where, to me, the, like, what is happening in, I mean, where I got to, John, was like, what is happening in reactive oxygen species versus nitrogen oxygen species? Cause they can go either way with reactive oxygen species. And like, what is happening depending on how deep the dysbiosis is in someone's physiology and in different, like someone may have extreme dysbiosis in their sinus microbiome. And yeah, we could trace it to their gut or we could trace it to their colon. Some people may have extreme dysbiosis just in their urinary tract. Like, you know what I mean? So then it's going to go like specific to that. How might we use the sattvic versus the rajasic urine? And it's like, it is the can of worms. It is like the, yeah, the Medusa.
Yeah. I 100% believe that it is a natural precursor and stimulator of nitric oxide. And obviously thousands of years ago, you know, this is the beauty of Ayurveda. What they knew thousands of years ago was just so profound. And I can go off on all the crazy things they knew about circadian rhythms. We can't see them. They knew about the microbiome, the creamy. We can't see them. How they made ghee is just like unbelievable. And then what a superfood it actually ends up being. And who thought that one up, how to make ghee and culture it and all of that. There is a researcher, his name Nathan Bryan, who's like the top researcher in the world on nitric oxide. And he's got a new book out recently. And he talks about how things can how you can create nitric oxide, or how you can actually, you know, block it. Like fluoride will block the production of it. Alcohol will block production. So we take an herb that's soaked in alcohol, like an extract that is mostly sterile. It does nothing for your nitric oxide cycle. However, if you take the whole herb, like triphala has been shown to increase nitric oxide production by 48%. Bacopa, you know, the studies show that when you take bacopa, nitric oxide increases. And if they significantly, you know, Centella Asiatica, ganeem, turmeric, all of these have an effect on nitric oxide when they're in their whole form. All the foods that you can eat, the nitrates and the nitrate-rich foods, nitrate and nitrite-rich foods can boost it. So I'm wondering, now that we have sort of this modern application of boosting nitric oxide in more of a natural way, do you think for the folks who just can't get over the disgust, that could be an option for them? Or do you think that the urine therapy really does provide something above and beyond what we can do with really targeting our food, which maybe we couldn't do thousands of years ago, to really optimize the production and keep that production alive and well as we age?
Yeah, it's like start where you are, right? And then just like notice what happens. So a few answers to this question, like what I think you might find super fascinating is in the Dhamma Tantra, like there's like prescriptions. So there's like herbal combinations that are in the Dhamma Tantra. So it's like, if you want this, take this, because anything you're taking is going to end up in your urine. For example, I was taking methylene blue last night. So today my urine was like blue green. It was beautiful, right? And then I'm upcycling that. So then the body needs less and it's adjusting. So whatever you're putting in, you're making medicine out of. So when you're talking about aged urine, it's like, what do you want to make medicine out of? And that's all in the Dhamma Tantra. That's like, if you get, you know, all these herbs that you just mentioned, like they're in the Dhamma Tantra of like, start using this if you want that. So I would say there's probably even an exponential effect, or at least I'd be curious if there is an exponential effect when you're not just, you know, using those herbs, but you're using those herbs according to the ancient texts. But let's talk about what is above and beyond, like just using the herbs, because this is something that I know for you and for me and for anyone who's an Ayurvedic healer out there, it's like there's the really tough cases to crack. There's people that have deep-seated ancestral trauma. And in Ayurveda, these are the highest vata cases. And the person is so deeply insecure on a core level, right? And on an unconscious level, that it's very hard for them to just get traction in their body and traction in their life. And I have seen nothing compare to Shivambu.
Wow. Well, so what's the difference between cow urine and human urine? I was working with an Ayurvedic doctor in India a while back, and we were trying to formulate something that would really work for blood sugar and diabetes, one of the epidemics on my body, right? And they gave me this prescription. It was a kind of a Shilajit-based formula, and it had cow urine in it. And I was like, okay, you know, this is not going to fly according to the FDA. We can't, you know, it's not going to work. Can you do it without the cow urine? And they're like, ooh, you know, we can't, it won't work without the cow urine. They said, well, let me think about, try to create some replacement. And they did, and they sent it to me. I tried it for months and months and months, and it didn't work. So we have this, obviously in Ayurveda in India, the cows are sacred and cow urine has got its medicinal property. What's the difference between that urine and the human urine in, like, how do you, where does that fall? Do you know?
Yeah, I mean, where I would, I don't know, like, because we don't have any studies. So it's like, what's our evidence is all anecdotal, right?
We do know why they would give, why did they put the cow urine in these
chlorophyll.
Formulas?
What was the, chlorophyll. What was
the, okay, just right. All the grass.
Yeah, all the grasses, all the microbiomes that are in all those grasses, all those phytonutrients, all those, you know, just microscopic phytonutrients that are getting digested by four cows' stomach. Cows produce an enormous amount of urine. Cow dung is 1/3 urine. So anywhere you're also seeing cow dung being used. Cow dung was used in historically to, this is, if anyone studying microbiome knows that, like, eventually you're going to end up in shit. Like, eventually you're going to end up in dung. You're going to end up in the largest repositories of microbes. And that's going to happen in dung, and it's going to happen in soil. And so in, this is kind of wild and stuff that just makes no sense in folklore. Like, a lot of Ayurveda, the old texts, made no sense to me 22 years ago. And there wasn't anyone to unpack it, to like make it make sense to me. But now it was like, oh, no wonder they were talking about, you mix cow dung with water, and before a baby's born, you spray down the place with cow dung water.
Wow. Yeah, of course.
Right. Let's have a complete ecosystem. Let's be born into a complete ecosystem. And we'll use that to sterilize. Right. It's like the opposite, right? Like, we'll use that. I don't know. We need a new word, like microbiomize, right? And so the urine is in the dung. So whenever you see a reference to cow dung, you have to also consider that there's cow urine in it. Whenever we're looking at cow urine, we're looking again at the Shivambu of the cow, right, of the holy cow, which is intact with its ecosystem. The human needs the cow as the intermediary between the ecosystem. As soon as we have hunter-gatherer and a hunter-gatherer societies, as the agricultural societies, the cow's microbiome is the intermediary between the ecosystem and the human being's microbiome.
So, you know, Kate, just when we got people to sort of maybe believe that they might even attempt a little bit of this urine therapy, a little maybe on their hand or their foot, and then we start talking about cow dung, I think we lost everybody. You know, we're gonna have to come back and do a deeper dive into cow dung and figure out what the science is on that. I applaud you, you know, because you're so cool. I mean, Kate is an amazing human being. She's just fearlessly going where no one's gone before and doing it in such a beautiful, eloquent, and fearless way. I love it. You know, these are the kind of things that, you know, nobody wants to talk about this, but, you know, when you kind of dig into the science, you're going, wow, it does make sense. And there's some logic to it, and there's some science to it. And I think that this is the kind of thing that motivates more science. And we need, obviously, more science. But you're, you know, holding the torch for this and bringing it back. And, you know, I just encourage anyone that's listening to kind of keep an open mind and, you know, stay connected with Kate, because she will provide the research. And I will do a deep dive into the research myself now that I'm all motivated again from Kate's incredible work that she's doing. It's really amazing. So Kate, let folks know where they can, you know, follow you on this journey that you're on.
Yeah, well, the book that has all this in chapters is on Amazon. It's called On Inflamed. And so there's chapters on everything from snort to swish to microbiome to nitric oxide. So it's all broken down in there for those that want the references. There are, I think, 300 references in that book. My club is at clubthrive.global, and that's where we work with people on primal habits and on strategic life design. So how do you design and live the life you want for you and in your family and in community and in your Dharma? That's all happening at clubthrive.global. And there's a free training there. So if you want to like jump in, you'll end up in our universe.
Cool. Kate, thank you so much. We'll definitely stay in touch. And so good to see you again. Thanks for the work you're doing. Really amazing.
Thanks, John. Yeah, such a pleasure to hang.
Hi, everybody. I just want to take a minute and tell you what we do here at lifespa.com. You know, I've been in practice now for 40 years, 38 of them been practicing Ayurvedic medicine full time. For the last 20 years, I've been writing articles and doing videos on the ancient medical wisdom of Ayurveda with the modern science. You know, if something's been around for 1,000 years, still practiced today, and you have modern science to prove it, boy, I really feel like that's something we should all be taking a look at. And that's what we do at lifespa.com. And all that information is for free. So just go to lifespa.com and search in your health topic, and you'll get the information, the article that you need, hopefully that will help you. While you're there, check out our Ayurvedic store. You can get there through lifespa.com or go to store.lifespa.com. And there we have all of our organic Ayurvedic herbs, organic skincare line, more books, tapes, knowledge that we give you is all there at our store. All of our cleansing kits are there in our store. All of our herbs are whole herbs with the natural occurring microbiome, the way it came out of the soil. And that's critically important, because if I took the bugs out of you, you'd be completely different. We take the bugs away from a plant, like sterilizing and making an extract or spraying your food with pesticides, you lose significant benefit of that plant. And that's why we use the whole plant with the natural occurring microbiome. So check us out, learn more about what we're doing here at lifespa.com, and we'll see you again.
This recording is brought to you by LifeSpa, where ancient Ayurvedic wisdom meets modern science. Get access to free health video newsletters by Dr. John at lifespa.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. These products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.